There is a common story we tell about America, that our fundamental values as a country were stated in the Declaration of Independence, fought for in the Revolution, and made law in the Constitution. But with the country increasingly divided, the story is not working for us anymore. And what's more, it's not even true. As Kermit Roosevelt argues in his reinterpretation of the American story, our fundamental values, particularly equality, are not part of the vision of the founders. Instead, they were stated in Lincoln's Gettysburg Address and were the hopes of Reconstruction. He writes about all this in his new book, The Nation That Never Was, where he shows how we can do all of these things by realizing that we're not the country we thought we were. Kermit Roosevelt III is a professor of constitutional law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, a former law clerk to Supreme Court Justice David Souter, and we welcome to the roundtable this morning. Kermit, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Professor of Constitutional Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, a former law clerk to Supreme Court Justice David Souter. What brought you to this particular story of reconstructing America's story?
It was a long process for me. I teach constitutional law. I've been teaching for 20 years. And one of the fundamental questions in American constitutional law is, who are we as a nation? What are our fundamental values? Where do they come from? And there's a particular way that we tell the story of America, which I absorbed growing up, and I taught my students for years in constitutional law. But I started realizing it's not true. And I started realizing it's destructive in many ways. It doesn't do what we're trying to do with it. And then I realized that there was a better story. So that's really what the book is about.
Where do you look for sort of where we were and where we can be? A better story. So where does that initially come from? I guess I'm looking chronologically of how we figure that out in reconstructing America's story.
Yeah, so the basic dilemma that we're facing as a nation now, I think, is we want to be honest about our past. And we want to squarely confront the bad things that have happened in our history. But we also want to tell a story about a nation that we can admire and believe in and have faith in. You know, we want to tell a story about an America that's good and has good values and has fought for those values and is moving in a good direction. And it's very hard to do that the way that we used to do it, which is to say our values are there in the Declaration of Independence and they're there with founding America. The problem with that mainly is slavery, because in 1776, slavery is legal in every state. We write a constitution that protects slavery in various ways. Pro-slavery forces control the national government for maybe the first 80 years of American history. So the story, the way that we've told it, it's hard to make that a happy story. And if you really think that American identity starts in 1776 and American values are there in the Declaration, it's hard to get around that dilemma. But it turns out that American values actually aren't there in the Declaration. When we say all men are created equal and we think that that means people should be treated equally by the government, that's not what Thomas Jefferson meant by that. That's not how people understood it in 1776. The way that we think about it now actually comes from abolitionists. It comes from people who read the Declaration of Independence in a new way and put in new values that weren't there in 1776. And so to the extent that our America is committed to this idea of equal treatment by the government and equal justice under law and rights for everyone, universal human rights, those aren't values that come from 1776 and the America of the founding. They're really values that come from a reaction against the exclusion and the injustices of the founding. And the war that makes them part of our America is not the Revolution, it's the Civil War.
So for those of us who look at where we are now and think we're in a really fragile, dangerous, maybe even bad place, is that worry warranted? And if it is, how does this information fill that in? Meaning, the nation that never was, we haven't gravitated very far.
Yeah, so I think we are in a dangerous time. I think that the perspective that I offer helps us understand it a little bit better, because what I'm saying is the values that we cherish as our deepest American values, they're not there at the beginning. People had to come up with those values and fight for them to make them a part of America. Not like America was born with these great values there and they've just sort of been naturally developed over time. People had to articulate those. People had to fight for those. And there was opposition. And there were setbacks. So these values, I say, they're sort of there in the way that the anti-slavery forces read the Declaration of Independence. They're there in the Gettysburg Address. They come into our Constitution in Reconstruction with the Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And Reconstruction works for a while. So after the Civil War, we set up a kind of functional multiracial democracy in the South. But it goes away, and it goes away because the federal government isn't willing to support it with the vigor that it needs. And basically, white supremacist paramilitaries in the South overthrow these integrated Reconstruction governments. And that's the period of time called Redemption, when white Democrats take back control in the South, and they impose segregation, they impose Jim Crow, they basically reimpose a system of racial hierarchy. So our values arrive in Reconstruction, they get suppressed in Redemption. The Civil Rights era is a second Reconstruction. And in the 1950s through the 1970s, we've got this attempt to once again bring those values back and make them real. And the second Reconstruction meets a second Redemption, starting in about 1980, and that's what's happening now. It's a pushback to the Civil Rights era. It's a pushback to the second Reconstruction. But if we fight for our values, we can make America the nation that we want it to be.
It has to be who's fighting for what, though, right? And we have to figure that out.
Well, right. And we have to figure out whether we believe in the America of the founding, which is an exclusive political community, people focused on their own rights, people who are suspicious of outsiders. Or are we Reconstruction America, which is an inclusive community, where we're saying birthright citizenship, right? That's one of the big innovations of the 14th Amendment. If you're born here, you're one of us. Before the Civil War, the Supreme Court said the American political community has a racial line around it, and black people can never be U.S. citizens. And that's kind of the worldview of the founding, which is the government is here to protect us, the insiders, and we're not concerned about the welfare of the outsiders. So, you know, do we have an inclusive or an exclusive political community? Do we believe that equality is important? Those are the questions that we have to face, and we have to realize there are different Americas in our history with different answers to those questions. And that's sort of what I'm trying to highlight. You know, America is not unified in its approach to these values, and we really do need to sort of decide who the heroes are and what values we want to fight for.
I realize this is going to be a big question because I'm going to pack a lot into it, but you can take it however you wish. But it seems to me that when you say divide, and I certainly understand that, I'm interested, I guess, when it comes to solutions of are two parties capable of coming up with a solution? And also just geographically, cities versus suburbs, red states, blue states, the Midwest and the South compared to the West Coast, the East Coast. How does that figure into coming up with a common ground?
Well, it's complicated. And, you know, in some ways, I think we're stuck with a bad hand. I think that a two-party system doesn't help us. I think we'd be better off with more viable political parties. And I think that there are structural features of our Constitution that don't help us either, and really that interact in harmful ways with our two-party system. So, you know, our general idea of separation of powers is corroded by the two-party system because people in Congress who should be checking the president's abuse of power, if they're members of the same party, their loyalty to that party makes them reluctant to stand up to the president. You know, we see this with Supreme Court appointments, too.
Right.
So we've got sort of partisan combat over the composition of the Supreme Court. The Electoral College is bad, I think. I think that, you know, equal state representation in the Senate is anti-democratic. And there are fixes for these things, and people are working on them. So, you know, admitting more states would help. Increasing the number of representatives would help. The National Popular Vote Compact, which is an end run around the Electoral College, would help. But the fact that we only have two parties means that we've got partisan gridlock. So it's hard to enact a lot of these good government reforms. And then in terms of the urban versus rural split, that's sort of interesting too, because, you know, if this were purely regional, if we had a regional split the way we did before the Civil War, I think we'd have a very real possibility of secession the way the country is now in terms of our polarization. Because it's more urban-rural, so that you've got, you know, basically blue cities and then red suburbs and red rural areas,
mm-hmm.
it's not possible to divide the country in that way. So in a certain way, we're all stuck together. And I think that doesn't necessarily make it easier to figure things out, to find common ground, but it makes it essential.
We're stuck together, and yet there seems to be a chasm in the knowledge that people who do not live in a city in an urban area and vice versa, that the understanding of what their issues, concerns, and really the problems that are coming. And so to overcome that, there has to be, I don't know, is that education? Is that understanding? I mean, to me, it's just empathy, but that doesn't seem to work. So then what?
Well, empathy is a big thing. So the ability to understand what other people's experiences are like, the ability to care about the welfare of people who are different from you. Empathy is a big thing. And, you know, we can try to teach that. And one of the things I do, in addition to being a law professor, is I write novels. It turns out that reading novels does help develop empathy, because it helps people imaginatively project themselves into the experiences mm-hmm. of others. So I'm in favor of that. I'm also in favor of education, civic education. I think it's very important to have an accurate story of American history. So that's one of the things that The Nation That Never Was is trying to do. You know, take a clear-eyed and accurate look at our history. Part of the problem is, like, social media and the internet, and the fact that there's so much misinformation and disinformation out there, and people tend to seek out information that confirms their ideological priors. And that's just a big problem, and I'm not sure what to do about it. I mean, that's not my area of expertise. But there are also people who are working on that, you know, and I hope that they can come up with some solutions.
We're talking about really big issues. We're talking about huge issues. And while we are talking, there are hearings taking place on just the fundamentals of our democracy. The fact that the peaceful transfer of power, which seems not to be overly glib, but a no-brainer, is being contested and argued about. All of the things that we have been talking about obviously need addressing, and quick, but we seem to be really far away from just the baseline that we need to be to figure out how we go on much longer, further, better.
Yeah, I'm afraid we are. I mean, the January 6th hearings are terrifying, as we learn more and more about what was going on and how well planned this actually was. But one of the things that we can take some comfort in, I think, is that if we look at the history, this is not anomalous. So the objection to the peaceful transfer of power and the refusal to accept the results of democratic elections, we've seen that before, more at a regional level than a national level. But that's the end of Reconstruction, right? That's how it happened. People refused to accept the results of free and fair democratic elections, and they basically overthrew the legitimate governments of the reconstructed South. And that's how the white Democrats took back control. So we've seen this before. we've survived it. You know, it took a lot of work by engaged citizens. It took the civil rights movement to actually bring the guarantees of the Constitution back to life. And it took almost 100 years in that case.
Right.
But we can do it, you know, if we identify what the values are that we're committed to and we're willing to make sacrifices for them.
Just your title, and I hope you don't take offense to this, but The Nation That Never Was, I mean, that's a bummer, isn't it?
Well, it's sort of a bummer. So the idea is our vision of founding America, our vision of America as committed from the beginning to these values of liberty and equality, that's a nation that never was. But it sort of comes from this Langston Hughes poem, America Again,
mm-hmm.
where he's saying, first, you know, America never was America to me. So for the outsiders, for the people that we've marginalized, America as the land of opportunity and promise and equality and freedom never existed. But in that poem, he goes on to say, it shall be, and we're the ones who can make it. So the story that I'm trying to tell is really basically that story. It's how the outsiders, the people who were marginalized, are the ones who gave us these values that we now want to say were ours from the beginning. And in that sense, it's an optimistic story, because what it's saying is when we see what America is missing, that's the nation that we want to make, and that's the nation that we can make.
Being a constitutional law professor, and as you said, you've been doing this for decades, I mean, obviously the courts play a huge role in this, and we're seeing the role that especially the Supreme Court is playing right now. And also, for many of us, very troubling. How does that play into all of this? And do they have an outsized role? Or does it fit in wherever your optimism is? Does that sort of fall in line with the correction of reconstructing the story of the United States of America?
Well, the Supreme Court has always been important. Usually, if you look at the broad sweep of American history, the Supreme Court has not been a force for good. So if you look at the first Reconstruction, the court is actually kind of opposing it. In terms of racial equality after the Civil War, the Supreme Court is not a supporter of racial equality. The Supreme Court reads the Reconstruction Amendments narrowly. It actually strikes down Civil Rights Act. So the period of time when the court is actually on the side of progress and equality is a brief period of time. It's basically the Warren Court era. And that exerted an outsized influence in the imagination of law professors in particular, but also the American public more generally. So we got this idea of the Supreme Court as an engine of progress or a protector of fundamental values. And that's, you know, that's not accurate. You can't rely on the court to do that. And one thing that we're seeing now, and maybe it's a good thing, is that the American people have to take the protection of American values into their own hands, because you can't rely on courts to do it. The other thing that I would say about the court, though, is this Supreme Court is worse than it should be, because this Supreme Court is drastically out of step with the result of the national popular vote in presidential elections. And if you're trying to think about how the composition of the Supreme Court should be determined, basically you've got the president appointing Supreme Court justices because the president is the only political figure elected by a national constituency. So when the framers of the Constitution gave the nomination of Supreme Court justices to the president, they were trying to do something that would reflect the national popular will. Now, we don't have that, in part because of the Electoral College. So, you know, we've got 6 Republican appointees out of 9 when the Republican candidate has won the national popular vote once in the past 34 years. That's a problem. But we've also got part of an imbalance on the court because of the way that justices are appointed and more because of the way that they leave the court. So given life tenure, and given that the justices' departures are sort of either unpredictable or strategic, who controls the court depends on chance, strategic retirement by the justices, you know, so that they can get replaced by a president who's going to appoint someone similar to them, and just sort of partisan hardball, like the refusal to hold hearings on Merrick Garland. And that's given us a court that's out of balance with the results of presidential elections, even if you take the Electoral College into account. And we can solve that problem if we have term limits for Supreme Court justices. If we have fixed 18-year terms, staggered so that each president will appoint two justices, then the Supreme Court will come back into balance with national popular opinion, and we won't have this very troubling divergence. So that's sort of a long-term solution. The immediate solution, and I support this, is expand the court, add four more justices, and we can bring it back into balance, you know, with where it should be.
And obviously the political power struggle that goes on in getting that to happen, right?
Well, yeah, it would be a political power struggle. And, you know, I don't think that we have the votes for it now, probably. But I would hope that decisions like the ones that the court has been handing down recently would increase support for that.
So help me out. You're brilliant. Why is it, if we are to believe the polls, and I don't know that we are, but if we are to believe the polls that tell us that a majority of Americans do not believe in the overturning of Roe v. Wade, we believe that a majority of Americans say that they want fairly strict, not completely strict, but fairly strict gun laws. And yet it seems to be a foregone conclusion that the midterms are going to go to the Republicans. I understand the economy. I understand those issues. I understand how those play into this. But if you're talking about something that we hope is temporary versus something that is the fundamental structure of our nation, doesn't that go further? And is basically I'm asking you, I mean, is there cause for any optimism of, because with changes in the Senate, with changes in the House, some of the things that you were talking about would be more possible?
It's hard to know what to say when elections don't go the way you want them to.
I find myself saying that a lot.
It's always
lately.
Tempting to say, well, the voters must be misinformed. Voters are upset about inflation. Voters are upset about high gas prices. I think the Democratic Party is not as effective in its messaging as it could be. Ultimately, you know, you just sort of have to hope that democracy works.
Well, exactly. But one of the things that I've learned, and I guess I've always known this, and because of, you know, of just looking at what has happened over our 200 plus year history, but what we have really learned in the last year and a half is how fragile that democracy is. And I mean, really, really fragile, as we see from these hearings. Does that make it stronger for the next time around, or does it weaken it even more?
Well, I think we're definitely at a perilous moment for our democracy. And in part, I think the problem that we're facing is kind of part of a consequence of the two-party system. Because I do think that the Republican Party saw demographics shifting against it, and that reduced their commitment to democracy because they realized that suppressing the votes of certain demographics was a way that they could keep power without actually getting a majority of popular support. And one of the reasons that you see divergence between public opinion polling and electoral outcomes, one of the reasons is, well, maybe people are misinformed and they don't really understand who's responsible for what, and they're not voting in line with the policy outcomes that they actually prefer. Part of it also is, you know, pollsters can reach people who might have their votes suppressed. So the democratic process, it should kind of be in line with public opinion, but I think there are a lot of people out there who are trying to put a wedge between those two things.
The name of the book is The Nation That Never Was, Reconstructing America's Story. It is published by the University of Chicago Press. Kermit Roosevelt, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is The Nation That Never Was, Reconstructing America's Story by Kermit Roosevelt III, published by the University of Chicago Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.